Welcome to Your Health. I'm Deborah Franklin. Swine flu, pandemic flu, H1N1, whatever you want to call it, we're still getting a lot of questions from listeners. Today, we'll get you some answers. Plus, the swine flu vaccine. The nasal mist version of the vaccine was rolled out this week, and in some places, healthcare workers were first in line. We'll hear how that went. And the startling tale of one girl in Texas who got the new H1N1 flu in July and is still recovering. We'll also hear more about Americans and their health insurance fates and fortunes from our series, Are You Covered? A few weeks ago, we asked NPR listeners to send in their questions about the H1N1 flu. Some of you wanted to know where to get the vaccine, when will it be distributed, and how, and is the vaccine really safe? Our reporters Richard Knox and Joanne Silberner sat down with Steve Inskeep to answer those questions and more. Here's Steve.
And we begin with NPR's Joanne Silberner, who's on the line. Joanne, where are you?
I am at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They have something called the Emergency Operations Center, where they take in information on swine flu outbreaks and vaccine availability, and pretty much everything on swine flu is being collected and analyzed here in front of me. There's a dozen screens with maps. They've really drilled for this, and they're taking this in stride.
So if you can't answer a question sitting where you are, we should be very, very afraid, pretty much.
Well, I have people here to help me answer questions. How's that?
Well, let's go through a couple. We'll start with our first question from Lisa K., last initial K., of Malvern, Pennsylvania. She writes, "The swine flu shot will not be offered by my family doctor. How exactly will this work, and where can I get my shot? So how will it work?"
Well, it's being run by the government. The government has already purchased essentially all the vaccine being made, and the states go to the CDC to order it, and each state gets a percentage of what's available based on how many people live in that state. Then it goes from the distributor directly to school districts, clinics, hospitals, pharmacies, about 90,000 places across the United States. And last week, millions of vaccines went on their way to the distribution centers and to the states, and that includes both the regular injectable vaccine and a new nasal spray version that's based on one that's already used for seasonal flu.
So that's the first part of her question, how will this work? And then her next part is, where do I get my shot?
Well, in Lisa's case, her doctor could apply to the state and get vaccine from the state, or she can call up her state health department, the Pennsylvania Department of Health, by its website or phone, and I think that's going to be true of most states.
We've also got questions from listeners who've written in with very specific questions about safety, Joanne, and we're going to get to those specific questions in a moment. But for right now, I just want to ask, are some of the people on those computer screens that you're looking at monitoring safety issues?
Yes, they're monitoring everything there is about this infection. And one of the people who's considering all the information that's being gathered, sitting right next to me, and her name's Dr. Beth Bell. She's with the National Center for Immunizations and Respiratory Diseases at the CDC. And I'm just going to hand her off to you.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Bell. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us here. I'd like to know how you think you're going to know if this vaccine starts to become a problem as you distribute it to those 90,000 sites across the country.
We are working very hard to make sure that we can closely monitor for adverse events once the vaccine is distributed. For example, we're working with a number of managed care organizations to track any adverse events that occur in their populations very quickly and to decide whether it's something to be worried about or not.
Are the side effects from the swine flu vaccine any different from the seasonal flu vaccine that many people get at the same time?
So far, the side effects are actually very similar. People will get a sore arm sometimes. Some people might feel a little bit tired, have a little bit of a headache. The kinds of side effects that one can expect to happen sometimes with various kinds of vaccines.
Dr. Bell, thanks very much. If you'd hand the phone back to Joanne Silberner, I'd appreciate it.
I certainly will.
Hi, Steve.
Just one other quick question. This emergency operations center that you're in the middle of, did they set this up just for the swine flu?
Oh, no. This is a place that's open 24/7. They deal with things like hurricane response, foodborne outbreaks, any other major public health event, they can deal with it here.
NPR's Joanne Silberner is at the Centers for Disease Control, the Emergency Operations Center there, and we're going to hear next from NPR's Richard Knox, who is monitoring developments from our studios here. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
He's our health and science correspondent. And how widespread are the safety concerns about this vaccine?
There seem to be a lot of worries out there. There was a poll the other day from the magazine Consumer Reports that found that two-thirds of parents are saying that they are either holding off on getting their kids vaccinated or they've decided not to have their kids vaccinated. Their main concern is that they think the vaccine may not have been tested well enough.
Let's listen to one of the questions that people have sent in.
Was it subjected to the same testing as the regular seasonal flu vaccine, or were shortcuts taken as it was rushed to market?
This gentleman's identified as Dr. Ian Zlotkis, somebody who asks questions himself, even though he is a doctor.
That's right. I think he's not alone out there. And for the answer to that, I'd like to go to Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
The H1N1 flu vaccine is made exactly the same way, with the same processing, with the same materials as we make seasonal flu vaccine, which has an extraordinarily good safety record.
He makes another point. He says the new vaccine really shouldn't be considered a new vaccine, a brand new vaccine at all. It's like what they do every year with ordinary flu vaccines. They make little changes. They tweak it. They call them strain changes. It's just that this is a very big strain change.
We had a question also from Erin Bolton of Baltimore, and she's in a group of people that has been strongly urged to get this vaccination. She writes, "I'm pregnant. My baby is due in December. I'm planning to get vaccinated," she writes, but she's concerned that results of vaccine studies in pregnant women aren't in yet, and she wonders whether she should wait.
I put Erin Bolton's question to Dr. Frank Witter. He's at Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore, and he's an expert in maternal-fetal medicine.
Erin, you should take the flu vaccine. Not only should you take the seasonal flu vaccine, but you should also take the pandemic flu vaccine. Pregnant women have gotten very, very sick from this new virus and have actually died. So you should take the vaccine.
Strong warning there, Richard Knox, but this is something that a lot of women may be reluctant to do when they're pregnant.
I think a lot of pregnant women are very reluctant to take anything. But we already know that pregnant women are much more likely to get swine flu. If they get it, they're like six times more likely to die from it. And that's really what Dr. Witter is emphasizing. A lot of his obstetrical colleagues worry that if they urge a woman to get vaccinated, then she happens to miscarry. It may have nothing to do with the vaccine because we have no evidence that the flu vaccines do cause women to miscarry, but they may blame it on the doctor. He says, well, you know, if that happens, I'd rather be blamed for a miscarriage than see a woman die from a flu that I might have helped her prevent.
We're taking listeners' questions about swine flu, and here's another one from Megan Guptill of Orinda, California. She writes, as a young person with asthma, I am in the group of people who are supposed to get the first round of the vaccine, but apparently she is hesitating, Richard Knox.
Yes, and by the way, people with asthma are a really big group. They're about more than 20 million Americans have it. The reason Megan is hesitating, I understand, is because she's wondering if she should get the first vaccine out of the block, which will be the nasal spray type. It's called FluMist. But people with asthma aren't supposed to get FluMist because it might touch off asthma attacks. So she's worried about getting swine flu while she's waiting for the regular vaccine to be available. Asthma experts are saying she should wait until she can get the regular flu shot, not FluMist.
We've been hearing, Richard Knox, about people who are worried about the vaccine, but let's talk a little bit here about people who say they are not that worried about swine flu. They wonder if it's really not that serious.
A lot of people have been asking that. I hear it all the time. For that answer, let's go back to Dr. Tony Fauci of the NIH. He's really the government's top flu specialist.
Although for the most part, it is a relatively mild infection, in the younger individuals who are getting infected, there's a small percentage, but a disturbing percentage, who go on to develop serious disease and even some deaths. About 30% of the deaths are in people who are otherwise young, vigorous, and healthy. You rarely, rarely see that with seasonal influenza.
You might ask the question the other way around, really. Wouldn't there be a lot of anger if the government had not developed this vaccine and a number of people, especially young, healthy people, had died?
Richard, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Richard Knox.
And to get answers to more of your questions, go to the NPR Health blog. Search for this title, We Answer Your Questions About Swine Flu. That'll get you to our web chat on the topic. Now, about the vaccine for that pandemic flu, it's here, sort of. About 250 doses in nasal spray form were given out this past week in Indiana and Tennessee. Hundreds of thousands of doses are in the mail to locations all over the country. Here's a conversation Melissa Block had with the CDC's head of immunizations.
I spoke with Dr. Anne Schuchat, and she had just visited Le Bonheur Children's Medical Center in Memphis. She explained who's receiving those first doses.
The state and large city health departments are directing the vaccinations to the places that can begin offering vaccine. Many of the states are targeting healthcare workers. We want those healthcare workers to be able to be healthy and able to work and also not spreading flu to their vulnerable patients.
Is it a voluntary program for healthcare workers in Memphis there? Yeah, I know in some places
absolutely.
It's not.
You know, in Memphis it's a voluntary program, and they were lining up to be among the first vaccinated. I think the staff at this hospital had seen the effects of flu firsthand. They'd set up a tent to care for the surge of patients that were coming in. So the nurses and caregivers were really keen to be able to protect themselves.
This first batch of H1N1 vaccine that's going out around the country, is that just nasal spray or is it a shot?
Yeah, the first several days of vaccination, we've just got the nasal spray available, and that's a great vaccine for people who are under 50 or over 2 who aren't pregnant and don't have chronic health conditions. We expect by later this week to have some of the first doses of the injectable vaccine making their way out to the sites. And, of course, there'll be more vaccine coming out every day. Each week there'll be more supply. But the first few weeks will be bumpy. We know that we don't have as much as we'd like to have. We made that decision to start the program as quickly as we could, even though we didn't have large stockpiles of the vaccine yet.
You said it might be bumpy. In other words, people might be looking to get the vaccine, being told they don't have it. They could get discouraged, right, and just turn off altogether.
We hope people will be patient. Vaccine is coming, and it'll be near you soon. But the first few weeks, it'll be going to a limited number of places. But we know that we've bought enough vaccine for everyone who's going to want to be vaccinated.
You mentioned that the nasal spray is not suitable for a number of people, including pregnant women, those with chronic health issues. Why is that? These are some of the highest priority groups for the vaccine. Why should they not be getting the nasal spray?
The nasal spray is a live vaccine. It's made from a live virus, but it's a virus that's been weakened so that it cannot cause flu. Nonetheless, we don't like to give those types of vaccines to pregnant women or people with chronic health conditions. They all can receive the shot, the killed virus vaccine.
What are you telling people if they want to get both a seasonal flu vaccine and the H1N1 vaccine? Can they get those together at the same time?
We think that it's fine to get two shots at the same time, the seasonal flu shot and the H1N1 flu shot at the same time in different arms. But we don't think you can get two of the sprays at the same time, the seasonal spray and the H1N1 spray. It's less of a safety issue than it is that we don't think they'll work that well if you give the two live viral vaccines at the same visit.
And how are people supposed to figure out who has the vaccine and where they're supposed to go to get it?
Most of the state or large city health departments are setting up websites or call numbers where vaccination venues will be advertised. They may not be available just yet because the supplies are really just getting allocated, but really stay tuned to your state or local health department. Look on their website, or if there's a 311 or other call number, you might try that. We do think we'll be posting links to those sites at flu.gov. So going to flu.gov will be a good place to be able to link in with your local or state health department.
Dr. Shugart, thank you very much.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's Ann Shugart. She's the head of immunizations for the Centers for Disease Control. She spoke with us from Memphis.
To Texas now, where the flu is never more than a cough or a sneeze away. The state's been hit hard by the H1N1 virus. Hospitals are seeing huge numbers of patients. Some schools have even closed. And while most who get the flu recover, a few have had a very hard time. NPR's Wade Goodwin brings us the story of one girl and her fight with the new flu.
The flu's initial attack was small. Leah Chikumbindi says her daughter Millie came back from summer camp not feeling great.
She was complaining of sore throat, and she was, you know, sleeping a lot at that time, but we thought it was just because of the being tired from camp.
Millie worsened, so they took her to their internist. It was July, and although the flu had not disappeared as it normally does during the summer, it had retreated. Their doctor diagnosed a virus, put her on a liquid diet, and advised over-the-counter pain medication. So that's what the Chikumbindis did. And although Millie didn't get better, the doctor had said to give it a few days. Her father, Joshua.
We had so much confidence what the doctor had first diagnosed, yet it continued to take over her strength.
On this occasion, their confidence was misplaced. Millie's back began to give her intense pain, and suddenly, on her way to the bathroom, the child was unable to stand unassisted.
And after that, my body started slowing down, and it started being hard to breathe and harder to walk.
Alarmed, the Chikumbindis called their doctor and told their daughter they were leaving right away. But Millie shook her head and said she wanted to go not to the doctor, but to the hospital. And with those words, the child likely saved her own life. They put her in the car and rushed her to the emergency room at Medical City Hospital in Dallas. Leah Chikumbindi says it was a shock when the doctors came out and told them their daughter was going to be put on life support immediately. But they had trouble grasping the depth of the threat. As they were preparing Millie for sedation, a nurse turned to the girl and gave everyone in the room a quiet clue. She asked Millie if she wanted a hug from Mommy.
That concerned me a little bit. Why are we hugging? If she's going to be okay, why are we hugging?
Because the nurse knew Millie was not okay. She had swine flu and double pneumonia, and secondary infections were about to attack. Over the next few days, her lungs failed. She had to be moved from a normal ventilator to a high-frequency oscillator. Then her kidney stopped functioning. Millie was undergoing multiple organ system failure, often an escort to the grave. But before this, Millie had been a big, strong, healthy child for her age, and she used that to cling to life, the pediatric intensive care unit fighting desperately.
They were doing everything, I mean, all day, and there was movement going on in her room, I would say every minute.
North Texas is being hit hard by H1N1. Health officials say the flu this fall is the swine flu, and it is virulent. Pediatricians are busy. Schools are reporting widespread absences. 6 children have died, 5 in Dallas and 1 in Fort Worth. 4 out of the 6 children had underlying health issues which contributed to their deaths. But 2 were like Millie, previously robust. John Carlo is the county medical director and health authority for Dallas.
And we've been keeping an active website. We've been putting flyers in utility bills. We've been, of course, on the local media, making sure that everybody's aware of the particular situation right now.
Carlo says more than 99% of the people who get sick with the current version of the swine flu live to fight another day.
The good news is that overwhelmingly most people will get over this after about 3 to 4 days. But, of course, individuals that are at high risk really need to be aware of the situation, see their doctor if they come down with this illness.
It almost got Millie Chikumbindi, but after 42 days in the hospital, 24 of them on a ventilator, she rolled out of there the winner.
The day I left the hospital, I went to go see all my nurses that took care of me, and they gave me hugs, and they wished me luck, and I was very happy to get home.
On a beautiful fall afternoon, the children in Millie's neighborhood frolic in the sun and the wind on the playground. Although she can't quite join them yet, Millie is back in school, 5th grade. It is almost over. She is being weaned off her blood pressure medicine, and next week, she too will be told, go ahead, go play. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
Another story this week comes out of our healthcare series, Are You Covered? It's about a mom and a dad who are self-employed and have learned just how tough and expensive it can be to find health insurance when it's not tied to your job. NPR's David Shaper has this report from Chicago.
15-year-old Evan Fisher is racing down the sidewalk on rollerblades in front of his home in Oak Park, a suburb just west of Chicago, and he's jumping up onto a homemade rail. Evan explains the sport called aggressive skating, which is similar to skateboarding.
You take some part of your skates and you slide it across a rail or a ledge or some object, and you do this like while you're moving. So you gain speed and then you slide across it.
Evan admits aggressive skating can be dangerous and that he should wear pads more often. After all, perfecting new moves is done by trial and error and occasionally crashing.
Oh. Well, I'm proud of what he does, and he works really, really hard at it.
Cindy Richards is Evan's mother.
But I wish he would wear pads, I wish he would wear a helmet, and I wish he had a safer sport.
Cindy's worries are well-founded. Last summer, while skating near his high school a few blocks away, Evan tried a trick on a railing on some stairs and fell hard. Even though he was wearing pads, he broke his arm badly.
I got to the emergency room, and they took the air cast off of it, and I looked at it, and I burst into tears, and he said, "Why are you crying, Mom? It's my arm." And I said, "Because it's your arm."
Evan's arm healed, but there was something else that almost made this mom cry again, the bills.
There's one for $315,
There's one for $95. There's one to the orthopedist for $607.
The ambulance, emergency, and doctor's bills added up to nearly $4,000, and Richards had to pay it all out of pocket. She's a self-employed writer and editor who buys her own insurance. Her policy has a high deductible of $5,200 each year. Richards' husband, Scott, is a self-employed carpenter. She says they, Evan, and 13-year-old Tess are pretty healthy. They don't go to the doctor very often. But after Evan broke his arm and she realized they were close to hitting the deductible for the first time, she rushed to the doctor for all kinds of things they'd been putting off.
I got a mammogram. I got a colonoscopy. I went in for my annual physical. I took the kids in for annual physicals. And it got paid for. And that was a really nice feeling.
Richards calls this self-rationing of health care. She doesn't skimp on taking the kids to the doctor, but she does pick and choose what kinds of examinations she gets based in part on what she can afford that year. Richards left her job as a writer for the Chicago Tribune 10 years ago to work as a freelancer. She went on COBRA for 18 months, and after that expired, she joined a writers' union for its health care coverage. She paid $1,200 a month. But after 3 years, Richard says the union plan went bankrupt without paying any of her bills. Still unable to find any other coverage, out of desperation, Cindy says she bought a temporary plan.
Because we really needed emergency care. My husband's a carpenter, and if he cuts off a finger at work, you'd be talking thousands and thousands of dollars in health insurance or in health care costs.
Richard says the temporary plan wasn't too expensive, about $600 a month.
But it covered nothing.
Richards then took a part-time job as a magazine editor, mostly because it offered health insurance. But after 4 years, she struck out on her own again.
When I was looking for this insurance, there were many days when I got no work done. And if I don't work, I don't get paid. Being on the phone with insurance companies, being on the computer trying to research things, it was all-encompassing. And the fear of having no insurance can be quite paralyzing.
Through a friend, Cindy Richards finally found a broker who was able to get her health insurance, but her husband, Scott, takes antidepressants, and his pre-existing condition forced them to buy two separate plans that together cost them more than $500 a month, and both have $5,200 deductibles. Cindy's and Scott's income can vary quite a bit year to year and ranges from about $50,000 to $120,000 a year, meaning their health care costs could eat up 10 to 20% of their income. As a journalist, Cindy Richards covered healthcare policy for 15 years. But when she started working for herself, Richards says she was shocked at just how difficult it was to find and buy her own insurance. And she still is not without nagging questions about her healthcare future.
What if I lose the policy is a big one. Finding this policy was a huge deal for me. Being able to have my entire family covered was a huge weight off my mind. The idea that we might get sick and they might cancel us, just like if you have a bad car accident, the auto insurance company will cancel you, the idea that that could happen to our health insurance is really terrifying. Because what are you supposed to do then?
For now, Cindy Richards is just relieved her family has any coverage at all. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Our series on health insurance in America, Are You Covered?, is produced in partnership with Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service. Explore the whole series at NPR.org.
So that's the story for many Americans. And now we're joined by NPR's Julie Robner, who's been listening along with us. She's going to help us explain how the healthcare debate in Washington might affect people like the family we just heard about. Julie, good morning.
Good morning.
How common are stories like we just heard?
Well, they are certainly not the majority. Most people do get insurance through their job or through a family member who has a job, about 160 million. But there's about 17 million people who are in what is known as the individual market. And those are families like the Fishers, where nobody works for an employer who provides health insurance. They get their coverage through this individual market. And everybody, including the insurance industry, basically agrees that this individual market does not work very well. Coverage is expensive when you can get it. Sometimes you can't get it. And often it doesn't provide very much in the way of benefits.
So would anything in the bills now being considered by Congress help people in that situation?
Well, all of the bills that are now pending are very much aimed at fixing this individual market, which, as I mentioned, doesn't work very well. The bills, for instance, would ban insurance companies from excluding people who have pre-existing conditions or charging more more for people who have pre-existing conditions. The bills would set up minimum benefit packages so people would know what kind of coverage they're getting, which, as we heard, is very important. And they would set up these health insurance exchanges so individuals can basically pool together their risk and get a choice of a number of different kinds of plans, and they'd be able to get more comprehensive coverage, something obviously that the Fishers would find important.
Does all of that cut the cost for a family like the Fishers?
Well, that's the hope. Now, all of the bills that are in Congress now have fairly generous subsidies for people who are poor and near poor. We're talking people earning $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 for families of three or four. The problem is that it's been very hard for Congress to raise enough money to pay for these bills. Remember, they're not allowed to add to the deficit. And as they've had trouble raising that money, they've had to scale back some of the help for more solidly middle-class families like the Fishers, the family we just heard from. And while all of the bills have thresholds beyond which people can't be required to buy coverage if they can't afford it, they don't necessarily make coverage affordable. So while they say there's this mandate, you have to buy coverage, they will say if you can't afford it, you don't have to buy coverage. But that would mean for a family like the Fisher that really wants to buy coverage, they wouldn't guarantee that there would be coverage affordable for them.
Wait a minute. There's this huge gap of people who aren't really poor, so they don't get that much help, but health insurance is very expensive for them. There's this huge group of people that has trouble paying for insurance, and you're telling me that group might get a little smaller, but it's still going to be there after all of this?
That's entirely possible. That's part of why they're having this debate over whether or not there'll be a public option, a government plan, because there's the hope that a government plan might push down the cost of health insurance. The insurance industry says no. That's part of the bigger fight that's going on over these bills.
NPR's Julie Robner, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
And our series, Are You Covered?, is produced in partnership with Kaiser Health News, which is a nonprofit news service. And by the way, it's an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente, the insurance company.
And that's all for Your Health. If you have any comments or requests, please email us, nprhealth@npr.org. I'm Deborah Franklin, and thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more on Your Health.